session number 24825, reel 3.
This is the second reel of a tag interview with Arthur Leggett in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 20th of the 1st, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Arthur, you've been speaking about, obviously, the situation for you at Bardia. 38,000 troops taken, I understand, and we're counting them by the acre. What was the situation then that you saw of Bardia on the completion of that particular campaign for you?
Well, on looking back, I think I must have been the most naive character in the Australian forces, because all of this was new to me. There was thousands, as we have commented, of prisoners coming out. Well, you never had time to count them. You just herded them all together and mounted a guard on the outer perimeter of that herd of men. So there could have been any amount in there.
You mentioned some of the pity that you felt. How were they treated generally?
Well, they were newly captured in battle, and there was no brutality of any sort, because we just didn't go in for that sort of thing at that stage of the war. But no doubt they felt hunger and open air. There was nowhere to quarter them. There was no food, to my knowledge, available for such a vast quantity of prisoners, and there would be very little water available to them, because we had overrun Bardia and we had control of all the stores, which we were using ourselves, as well as quarters and such like. So they were out in the open with whatever they possessed, which unfortunately is a situation prisoners of war find themselves in. Whatever they have with them at that moment is their worldly possessions, and they then have to rely upon the conqueror to supply them with the necessities to keep them alive.
I understand that there was actually a lot of booty and loot taken from Bardia, as I understand. Things like motorbikes and supplies.
Yes, I suppose you could call it loot. It would be taking over the enemy or your former enemy's equipment. I may have mentioned earlier, suddenly as a signaller, the desert warfare is a bit like being in a ship at sea. That there's space everywhere and there's big areas to be covered. And consequently, there was really no static positions for a battalion, and the areas to be covered were comparatively vast, of course, bigger than the textbooks ever imagined. Telephone lines, when they were run out, usually they had to be reeled in again, because we were always short of cable. And we found after the fall of Bardia, there was motorbikes everywhere, and being young and full of adventure, we had 30 men in our platoon, and we had something like 25 motorbikes running around, being used as dispatch riders rather than laying out telephone cables and static telephone situations. Our colonel, of course, he soon put a stop to all this, and he minimised the dispatch riders down to 4 men, and on the understanding that they found their own fuel, oil and other supplies for the motorbikes. Well, there's an abundance of that everywhere, and they played quite a prominent part as far as conveying messages to companies around the battlefield generally when we had reached a fairly static position.
What did you actually see of the town?
I personally saw very little of it, because we were, to my knowledge, the reserve battalion of the reserve brigade. And once the place, we had advanced as far as we could, but as I was commented To my knowledge, we were the reserve battalion of the reserve brigade, so we were well back. And although we did penetrate into the outer defences of Bardia, I personally, at this stage of my life, haven't got a clear recollection of that town.
Do you have any recollection of the actual battlefield at all? Remnants of an advancing troop and that sort of thing? Wreckage?
No. We didn't get in any of the real close fighting. We were spread out, of course, over a big area, but mainly the artillery barrage and the forward battalions or forward brigades even had got through the barbed wire and more or less taken the place before we got to it.
So, what was the situation in relation to the confidence that this experience gave you?
Oh, it was a terrific morale booster, of course. Our first battle, and we all had a wonderful victory, which it gave us confidence, which I feel was misplaced or was the wrong impression to get, because somehow we got the impression that's how good we were, and we weren't. We just happened to be fighting an enemy who were not very keen on fighting. And that was why we appeared so spectacular in our successes.
Then in relation to this whole sort of period, presumably you were to then move further west.
Yes, we then journeyed from there to the outskirts of Tobruk.
What did you know of Tobruk?
Oh, just another town along the coast. That's all we, as an infantry bloke, that's all I knew. And I think that's all most of our fellows knew. No doubt, the officers, they were well instructed on it, but down at the platoon level, no, I don't think we knew a great deal about it, no.
So this period, January the 3rd, 1941, Bardia falls, then it would be the 22nd of January. What was happening in that period? Were you able to relax at all?
Oh, yes. Well, yes, there was very little movement. I have an idea that we were in some quarters of some sort at Bardia, but I can't really clearly recollect it. I know there was a bit of a port there, but I'm not quite... It'd be wrong of me to give any impression, I'm afraid, because it's just that long ago.
So, what was your situation in Tobruk when you had come up to that area?
Well, we took up a battalion position. I'm not quite sure exactly where we were there, but it was pretty... there was some scrapping there, which I can't recollect at this stage. But there... again, we were not in the signal platoon, or me in particular, weren't involved in forward positions. I was back at battalion headquarters at that stage. And again, Tobruk... I know it's got a big harbour, and we settled in there in a quartermaster's store, I suppose, a divisional store, big shed full of equipment, and we were there for several days. There's one humorous incident. I know we got a message to say there was a few Italian prisoners down in the front, and we sent some men down to pick them up. So the company commander that I was attached to sent a few men down there, and about three quarters of an hour later, I said to him, "Say, you better come and have a look at this." And coming around the perimeter of the harbour was a long column of Italian prisoners, and in front of them there was a couple of, I think it was three Australian soldiers. The Italians were carrying the Bren gun, and they were carrying the ammunition case and such like. The officer, of course, pulled them up, wondering what the hell was going on. And he said, "Well, they're such a friendly mob." He says, "They come out of buildings and holes in the ground." He says, "So I told them to come along with us." And so the officer upbraided him a bit and wanted to know what they were doing carrying his Bren gun and ammunition. He said, "Well, they wanted to do it, so I couldn't see any harm in that." So, anyway, the Bren gun was taken off the Italians and they were sent on their way. It was just rather humorous at the time, but that's how the things were.
There was really no interest, particularly with the Italians.
No, there was over 1,000 men following these two blokes along, and they could have overpowered them. But where were they going to go? What are they going to do?
There's a sense that they were sort of fairly jovial in some respect.
Well,
quite happy to have been taken prisoner almost.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, they were all conscripts. And those that we met who had been in Australia had gone back to Italy to see their parents, and immediately they were conscripted in the army and sent to North Africa. Well, they had no desire to fight. They had no desire to be there. And no doubt, of course, heavy artillery barrages play a big part in demoralising men. And when your forward lines crumble and the enemy penetrates it, you've lost it. So what can you do? And apparently that was their attitude. Well, what can we do? There you go.
What did you see at Tobruk?
Just the harbour. We never, the company again that I was attached to, I had been sent for, I'll just recapitulate here. That battalion headquarters at the Battle of Bardia, and I think when we took up our positions outside Tobruk, those men who attached to forward companies were brought back, and those of us at battalion headquarters had been split up into pairs and attached to companies. And that's the way things worked. You had two signalers with each company to communicate back to battalion headquarters. I was attached to D Company, and all I can remember of it was we're on the outer perimeter of Tobruk Harbour. We could see Tobruk Township itself in the distance, but our particular company did not enter there. We were under the command of D Company, under the command of Captain Egan.
Further west, I understand, you were to go, and about a week later you were involved in the Battle of Verdun.
Yes, that was a different situation. We pulled up there, or we were pulled, the convoy in which we were travelling was pulled up by staff headquarters, who had pointed out that the aerodrome just in the distance, there had been some light fire from the hangar area, but judging by the way the Italians had behaved at Tobruk and Bardia, it would be just want to flush them out and get rid of that nuisance. But it just turned out that they were dug in, and they were a very determined bunch of Italians. The company which had been told to advance across the flat of the airport had no cover of any sort, and they were subject to machine gun fire when they got within range. A couple of tanks, I understand, also made an appearance, but they were chased off. And there was a few men lost there, and it was quite a nasty old stink. And that was the situation on the aerodrome, and the company, as I attached to, moved around to the right of the aerodrome as you were advancing towards the sea. There was a fort along the road, Fort Ruderio, I think it was called. It was between the aerodrome and the end of the, or the top of the escarpment. We skirted around that. Again, I must point out that I was just a bloke attached to a company, and I had no idea of the overall battle campaign. This is just where we were. And it was obvious that you could not advance along the road down the escarpment with the fort being there, because you were subject to shell fire. There was also another fort further along the road. We were advised to go down the escarpment and make our way along the flat below the escarpment. Well, when we got down there, we found that it was fortified with an artillery line, barbed wire, machine guns, and what have you. And we were subject to a creeping barrage for quite some time, and we were pinned down there for several hours, and we had to wait until it was dark before we could get out of that position. We had to, we lost quite a few some men, and we had to go back and climb up the escarpment again to the top, where we stayed the night, the rest of the night, by a stone wall, crouched up against this wall in the rain, waiting for further orders.
This, as you had mentioned earlier on, is basically your first real experience of heavy fire.
That was it, yeah.
What was it like to cope with your first experience?
Oh, horrendous. Horrendous in a way. You were naturally, you can see this, the earth in front of you just jumping up, and dust cloud gradually getting closer and closer, and you're then in it. Well, you've got shells bursting around. You dig into what little hole you could or any little indentation. And my mate and I were looking around for something to hide behind, and we saw a stone cairn stuck up about 4 foot high, so we raced over and crouched behind that. And one of the chaps told us we're hiding behind an artillery sighter, obviously. Well, we reckon we were pretty right. They wouldn't knock that over. But then once the barrage had passed, you felt it shaken, of course, but then it started to come back again from the rear to the forward. It was, there's not much you can do except hang on and pray to God it won't hit you. That's about all you can do. You're scared all right, it's not funny. And, well, you live through it and you're shaken, though. You're certainly shaken, yeah.
How long would that period last?
I'm not quite sure. I would say that it went on for a good half hour, but then we had got that far forward, the artillery couldn't do a great deal about us, but we were pinned down with machine gun fire, and we just couldn't. And then there was all the barbed wire and other equipment between us and the town, and there was obviously no way of taking it from where we were, and that's when the company commander received orders to get back up the escarpment when it was dark.
Yeah. Were you a religious man? At a point like that, were you to be praying?
Oh, I think you do pray a bit, but I don't know, you hang on a bit. Well, to ask if religious, of course, I have a great believer in a creator, but these days I'm afraid I don't quite know who he is. We're taught there's a creator in the Christian language, but so does every other language reckon there's a creator. And I don't know, if we have a creator, I think he's turned his back on our world for a few thousand years from what I can see of history. And again, if you're going to quote the Bible, a thousand years is nothing in the eyes of a creator. But that's just my opinion. But I will state now that I do believe that a lot of my inner strength came from a religious conviction, by the way.
I'm interested in people who talk about their first encounter of close combat or close bombing, and one of their fears is that they might actually not hold their bottle together and let the other chaps down in not being able to cope.
Well, I never had that feeling. No, I of course I got frightened, but I'm afraid the esprit de corps and all that sort of thing was a bit strong, especially with the situation we were in. We, being paired as signalers, come from battalion headquarters to a rifle company who didn't know us, we didn't know them, therefore we were going to show them we're as tough as they were, sort of thing. So the esprit de corps of your own little platoon played its part, and you were just so determined that whatever you had to do was going to be done.
Simple. You don't let it show.
No, you don't let your fears. Well, nobody lets their fears show if they can help it. No, oh no, you can't compare actual action with what you see in movie pictures, because you just don't get that. You're all committed to, well, in case of kill or be killed. It's as simple as that.
So Derna works out okay eventually.
Oh, well, we got Derna eventually fell. They got around behind it, but the pressure from the top, the 2nd 8th played a big part. They were on top of the escarpment with us, on top of the Wadi Derna, and they played a big part in that battle. But eventually our platoon overrun the 2nd fort, which was a mud brick type of thing, and then the Italians blew the roadway going down the escarpment and started to burn tanks and oil tanks and so on the far side of the town, so we knew then that they were contemplating evacuating it. And our company I was attached to, the battalion just moved into the town without any hand-to-hand fighting and that nature. The Italians just retreated en masse. There was no hand-to-hand fighting through the town, to my knowledge anyway.
Off you go westward again?
Yes.
What was the general day-to-day routine? We were obviously preparing for combat.
Oh, well, there was sitting around a great deal, of course, and getting fed. That was important because you move that fast. It's a bit hard for the cooks to keep up with you. I know everyone rubbishes cooks in the army, but they did a magnificent job. Where we'd be travelling all night and pull up at midnight to bivouac, the cooks would produce a meal for you at midnight, and they'd been travelling and just as long and as hard as we had in vehicles.
What did that meal consist of, generally?
Oh, mainly bully beef and biscuits and stew of dehydrated vegetables, which were cooked up mainly. There was no fresh stuff, it was all. No, down on the flat at Derna, we were sharing up tins of bully beef, one to three men, and biscuits the same. It was a bit rugged down there, in that area.
How were you health-wise at this point?
Oh, well, we're all in tip-top health long before that started. I mean, we've been doing desert warfare and living tough for months in Palestine. Although we were fed well, everyone was in excellent physical condition. There was just no problem there. You'd get tired, naturally, lack of sleep. That was true. And between Derna and Benghazi, it rained like hell. And the whole desert became a quagmire, which that took a lot of handling, especially when you're wet and there's no shelter. You're out there, you know. But, that takes a little bit of handling.
It's for the morale.
Morale, man, he's tired. And you get cranky if you're hungry, all these things add up. But we weren't dug in trench warfare, we were moving, and this all helps a bit, of course. I can't imagine how anyone ever lived through France in the First War, I just don't know. But we were moving, and we moved down onto Bachi. We were in the general direction, our battalion went in the general direction of Benghazi, but we never entered it. We went around to Bachi, I understand it's the place, and we followed around to Benina. And then the 7th Armoured Div, they'd done a big race around through the desert country and got between Benghazi and Tripoli to cut the Italians off. And we went down that way to lend them a hand, but it was all over by the time we got to a place called Saluk. And there were thousands of prisoners there, and that would be one of the most miserable moments periods I spent. There was acres and acres of prisoners all packed in together, and we were standing around them on guard, and it was raining like hell. They were wet and hungry. We were wet and hungry, and it was just a very nasty night. Then the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, I think it was, they took over our duties. Was it them? I'm not sure. And we moved back eventually to a place called Tokra.
By this stage, there hadn't been any mention of the Germans, I presume.
There was a little bit in the paper that a German division or German unit, anyway, had landed at Tripoli, and that's just what all was said about.
What was their reputation in relation to, okay, well, you've been fighting the Italians. Do you expect anything different from them?
Well, again, as I said, the ease, put it that way, with which we conquered the Italians, if you can use that phraseology, I think gave us a false impression. And we did receive lectures from eminent officers after that the fighting the Germans was going to be a different proposition entirely there. And, well, fighting people is what you come up against at that moment. You don't know much about it before then. I mean, so
you mentioned obviously that there was some mention of Germans arriving in Tripoli on the 12th of February 1941. What had you heard of Rommel, if anything?
Oh, I never heard of him. Never heard of him until I was in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. No, see, we had that show up to Benghazi. We did hear the Germans are up in Tripoli, but that's all right. There are a few Germans up there, so what? It's a long way away. And because we were moved back and up into Greece and Crete and those places, well,
what did you know of the change of tactics? Had anyone told you that that might be on the cards?
No, no one had told us, and so for months there, well, no, just knew nothing about it. See, when you're just a regimental number within a regiment, you're only really concerned with what you are doing at this stage. You're not a politician, you're not a historian, you're just doing a little bit within the 30 men that you're associated with in your platoon. At least this is my impression, and there could be other men with different ideas, but again, as I say, I wasn't exactly an educated bloke, I was very naive, and a lot of things happened that took a lot of understanding.
Well, people talk about a football match played in the desert. What did you know of that?
Yeah, that could be so. We often played other battalions' football matches and things of that nature, yeah. Oh, yes, that could be.
The 2nd 28th coming up.
Yeah.
As you came back.
Yeah, yes, that's right. There was one there. It was at Bardia too, I think, if I remember rightly. We met them at Bardia or some town adjacent to Bardia, because I met my old teenage mate there. You know, we've been knocking around for years, and he joined the 2nd 28th.
What was your impression of the people in command of you, people like Wavell?
Oh, a bit pompous. I don't think we weighed a great deal. We assumed that they were quite capable men and they could do these things. We just feel we did see them. They made a few addresses to divisions and what have you. But I personally wasn't over impressed with any of them because they were that far above where I was functioning that, left it to them. They knew what they were doing, good on them, and they're awfully British, and therefore must be right.
When was it that you first realised that you were going to head off to Greece?
Oh, we're back at Amaria, and we were told then that we were going to Greece.
What did you know of the general importance?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
People talk of Churchill's soft underbelly idea and that sort of thing.
No, I don't think... I know that was the idea then, but I didn't know it at the time. And we were going to Greece to drive the Germans out because the Greeks were driving the Italians out and we were going to give them a bit of a hand. And that's all it was about it. Well, then Germany came into it and changed the situation considerably.
Tell us of the trip to Greece.
Oh, well, that was in a troop ship. I'm not quite sure what the name of the ship was. I think it was the Thurland Castle, but I'm not sure on that one. That cropped up somewhere. But anyway, it was a troop ship. We were taken up to Greece. It wasn't a bad voyage as far as I was concerned because signals are up on the bridge and communication between ships if necessary. And we could also see the escorting Navy ships there, which give you a sense of security. The ship I was on was a Dutch ship. The officers and most of the crew could talk English as well as I can. And I remember being on the bridge one day up, not far out from Greece, and a Bristol Blenheim bomber came right down and flew between the ships. And I thought, gee, that's far. It was like a twin-engine bomber. And the Dutch officer looked at it and he sniffs and says, bloody obsolete. And I thought, gosh, I thought that was the latest thing because all we'd seen up till now had been Westland Lysanders and Gloucester Gladiators. So although we were going into a situation, I thought we had everything with us going well. We had aeroplanes and so on, but we never, of course. The port of disembarkation was Piraeus, which had been blown to hell 2 days before we got there. An ammunition ship had been hit and blew up and wrecked everything for miles around. We were taken ashore in fishing boats from the ship that we were in. And we went to a place called Daphne, I think, for a day. We were then put in trains and taken right up to the front, up near the Yugoslav borders, somewhere up there.
What was the general feeling on the island of Greece when you got there? Greece
itself, uplifting, because there was mountains. Everything was green. Flowers were growing naturally. It was so entirely different from the desert. This in itself, plus the fact that there were cities there full of people and they were all enthusiastic about you being there. It's a complete contrast to the desert where there was nothing but sand and space, whereas here it was, and plus the fact that it was the seat of all learning, at least we knew that much, and you felt as though you were doing your bit to preserve history.